This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Thank you very much for downloading episode 39 of the Retro Asylum podcast. Myself, Matt Denaris, on the mic this time. We've got part two of the Dino Dinny interview. So if you haven't listened to the first one, episode number 37, go and download that now and come back here. You back? Brilliant. You listened? Excellent. This is episode 39. Like I said, the Dino Dinny interview part two. It's a little bit shorter, this part. The first part was quite lengthy. We went quite deep in some technical discussions, talked about kickoff, obviously goal, obviously Dino Dini's soccer, obviously, you know, lots of stuff in there, quite obvious. Going off the beaten track on this one a little bit, we're going to talk about life after goal, really. What happened to Dino after goal and Dino Dini's soccer? What happened after that? And also going to talk about indie games, amongst many other things. It's a really good discussion, actually, but like I say, it's a little bit shorter. So keep tuned for that. First of all, need to mention, of course, the Retro Revival event coming up on the 18th and 19th of May, which just happens to be next weekend. Even less than a week away, if you're counting down the hours, minutes and seconds. Organised by Chris Wilkins of Retro Fusion, it's going to be massive, I think, you know, not maybe in terms of size, but certainly in terms of content. Some great people on the guest list. Oliver Twins, who wouldn't want to see them? Arch McLean, fantastic. Arch McLean, Snooker, IK Plus, Drop Zone, brilliant, brilliant stuff. A lot of Ocean, ex-Ocean employees are there, along with the Newsfield publishers or writers, should we say, from the Zap and Crash days, and some of the great artwork from Oliver Frey. If you don't know who Oliver Frey is, I urge you to get on Google and search him out. One of the greatest sort of artists, certainly for magazines, that there ever has been. Real unique style, brilliant, brilliant stuff. But also there's going to be pinballs, going to be arcade machines, old computers, obviously, without a shadow of a doubt. One of the most interesting things, I think, is going to be the Virtuality VR machine, which, if you don't know what this is, again, pop onto Google. When these first come out in the mid-90s, I remember seeing it on many computer shows just simply because it was something really out there and new. You stand in a ring-type device, put on a headset, well, not a headset, but on a headpiece, much like the Virtual Boy, should we say, and hold out a controller in front of you. You look a bit of a fool, in all honesty, and it is quite primitive compared to 3D of nowadays, but at the time I'm sure it was great. Looking forward to maybe trying that out if the queues aren't too big and so on. You know, there's just so much going to be there. It's not worth me going through it now, but the Retro Asylum crew will be representing. I'm hoping to get myself down there, certainly for one of the days, still not confirmed, but Andy will be down there, Dean will be down there. There's going to be quite a gang there. We're going to hold a few competitions with the listeners, just fun competitions, just to get you involved in the whole Retro Asylum thing. You'll spot some of us because we'll be wearing Retro Asylum t-shirts. If you can read, of course. If you can't read, then just look for some people that you think might run a podcast. We've got a certain look about us. They're quite easy to spot. We're the ones holding microphones. Anyway, so that's Retro Revival next weekend. Again, shout out to Chris Wilkins. I'm looking forward to it if I can get up there. If I can't get up there, I'm going to be gutted. Let's put it that way. Also, we've had two auditions for a new co-host for the Retro Asylum podcast. If you don't know what we're doing here, we are holding auditions essentially for a new co-host. You record a little section, send it in, and so on, and you may win. I don't know whether win's the right word, but you may become a co-host on the Retro Asylum. Even if you don't become that co-host, there's no doubt you'll be involved in the podcast at some stage again. So we've had Captain Blood 7, and also we've had Andrew Joseph, who runs the Yoke Folk Forum. both good auditions. There's still time to get yours in. We've got some more coming up. Firstly, we've got Anthony Ogden, who you might have heard his name as being one of the show sponsors recently. Dirk Dig Dugler also coming up, along with Hooli Cool. But like I say, there's plenty of time to get your entry in. If you want to become a co-host on this podcast, get an entry. Can be anything from 10, 15 minutes up to an hour. You know, just talk. Just show us what you got. When I first started doing this podcast, and I'm probably one of the ones who can promote this a little bit better than maybe Andy and Dean and Glenn, who've been on here right from the start. I come on a bit later on and did a little 10-minute slot on one of the episodes. When I first started recording, I've not got a problem with hearing my own voice. I don't like it. Don't get me wrong. I don't think many people like their own voice. But I've done a lot of, I suppose you could say, public speaking. I've done a lot of talking on radio shows before, from when I used to DJ a lot. So I've not got a problem with confidence, particularly on a microphone. However, as soon as you press record, and you know, this little section I've done so far, I've recorded a couple of times already because I wasn't quite happy with the way it was going. It's a skill to it. It's definitely a skill to it, but it's one that anyone can learn, really. If you can talk, which I'm sure the majority of us in this world can do, you can host on a podcast. You've got to show a little bit of enthusiasm, show willing, and just show your passion more than anything. Your passion is what will show through. Enthusiasm can come naturally, and you might find if you're doing an hour-long show, you might start off a little bit sort of, I don't know, monotonic is probably the wrong word. You might start off a little bit nervous, a little bit sort of within yourself, and you'll slowly come out. As the passion starts coming through, you will feel more and more confident in front of the microphone, and you'll just find that it starts coming out. I tend not to plan shows. I tend not to plan anything, because I find just talking brings out the best in me. If I'm reading from notes, it gets a little bit sterile possibly, so I just go with it, and that's what I think you should do. So what you need to do is send in your demo to andy@retroasylum.com. And you may be picked to co-host. You may be picked to play a part in the podcast in the future. So good luck to everyone. Good luck to Captain Blood and Andrew Joseph, who have already been. And those are coming up very soon. Therefore, on to what I've been up to. So I had quite a productive weekend when it comes to retro gaming. Didn't play many games, but I managed to get a good few pickups. Went to a car boot sale locally. It was pretty poor, actually. The car boot sale itself was all right. The usual kind of stuff for sale in terms of retro gaming, it was pretty poor. I saw a battered old GameCube. I wasn't even going to waste my money on that. I've got a couple of GameCubes, and they're in great condition. One's chipped as well, which is fantastic. Did I say that? I probably shouldn't have said that with Nintendo, the big dogs hovering down. There were some Xboxes there, nothing really standout, bar a PlayStation 1. But how is a PlayStation 1 standout, you might ask? I've got two PlayStation 1s already. I've got no real reason why. I didn't have the console when it first came out. I've got no real allegiance to the PlayStation right through its generations. So why did I look at this one? Well, I took a look at it. I thought, you know, that looks like one of the earlier models. Now, I'm quite into hi-fi. I wouldn't say I'm massively into hi-fi. I just like good sounding music on a nice sounding system, and I've always heard that there's this the audiophile version of the Sony PlayStation. Essentially, one of the earlier models of the PlayStation had proper phono outs on it, and within certain circles of the hi-fi world, it's been quite revered as being a really nice sounding CD player with a sort of character of its own, and certainly not what you expect from a games console. So I walked away from this PS1 sort of with a little bit of trepidation. They'd quoted me, I don't know, 12 quid or something, and did a little bit of research on Google quickly as I walked away, just to see if that was the model or what model I need to be looking out for. Found the model number. I thought, I'm not going to go back straight away. Show's way too keen. You need to do some haggling at these car boots, of course. So I walked around a little bit, and I thought, I better go back soon, just in case someone else gets it. Went back, another look at it. Very friendly couple on the stall. Looked at it, and it was the model. It had the audio outs on it. Well, you know, I like fiddling around with hi-fi. I like doing sort of comparison tests with different sources of audio. So I thought, yeah, go on. Let's have this. Let's have this. Managed to get it down to, I don't know, 9 quid I think it was from 12. They weren't budging any lower than that. I said, I've got no idea whether this works. They said, trust us, it works. Here's my mobile number if you want it. God knows whether it was the person's real mobile number, but I had to trust them face value. It was in quite decent condition actually, and after a bit of a clean up, it's almost immaculate. You know, there's one small mark on it, the rest of it is absolutely brilliant. Found a couple of PlayStation 1 games hovering around, Time Crisis and Oddworld, on a couple of other stands. Managed to pick them up for £2 in total, so 11 quid. Nice. I was quite happy with that. Having tried it out, it worked perfectly, no problems at all. Couple of controllers with it, one DualShock, all the aerial cable, the RF cable, etc. Got it back onto the hi-fi and it sounds nice. I'm genuinely pleased with it as a CD player. It's a bit of a faff because I've not got it connected to a screen, so I've kind of got to guess which buttons to press, but it does sound really good. So if you're a bit of a hi-fi fanatic at all, and into a bit of a bargain, get yourself one of these, have a listen to it. It's really nice sounding. I'm going to put a link in the show notes actually, because there's some guy on eBay who's been modding these PlayStations and they look fantastic. You know, really good design. One particular one which makes it look like a high-end bit of audio kit, it's got a little tiny LCD in it, which LCD screen, which shows the PlayStation running. So I'm not quite sure how you'd want to play Wipeout on that, but as a CD player you can finally see what tunes you're selecting. Anyway, so that was the first pickup. Rest of the car boot was pretty naff, to be honest, but I've been watching this Atari Jaguar on eBay. It's pickup only. You often get a bargain with pickup only. It's been mentioned on the Retro Asylum forum as well that get a pickup only, you're going to get a little bit of a bargain, because not the whole of the eBay market doesn't live near this one person. Anyway, it was 20 miles down the road from me. It listed a fault that sometimes you get a red screen come up, which needs the cartridge reinserting. And I thought, well, it can't be that much of a serious problem if it's still working. So I watched it, put a bid on it last minute. I'll freely admit I'm a sniper, because everyone else is on eBay these days. So, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. I don't agree with the practice particularly, but again, if you can't beat them, join them, essentially. This Jaguar had with it Doom, Syndicate, Theme Park, Tempest 2000, and some other games. I can't remember what they were now, some lesser known games that didn't register on me, but Tempest was in immaculate condition. So I thought, right, well, Tempest alone goes for about 15 quid on eBay. This could turn into a real bargain. Got it for 26 quid, had to drive over there, add on the fuel, probably 30 quid for this Atari Jaguar. Got it back home, again in really, really good condition after a bit of a clean up. I like to clean anything I get. It looks almost immaculate once again. It works almost perfectly. You get this issue sometimes with red screen blowing the cartridges like you do like SNES and Mega Drive cartridges. Pop it back in, away it goes. Doom's great, Tempest 2000, absolutely brilliant. Really, that's the main thing I bought it for. I've always wanted a Jaguar, but there isn't that many killer apps on the Jag. But Tempest 2000 is one of them, and I love Jeff Minter's games, and I love Tempest, so put them together, bosh, you got a great game. Never really played Doom in anger before, so Doom is a game that's kind of washed by me over the years. I know what it looks like. I've certainly had a go on it. Never played it in anger. Never played many first person shooters. It's not my kind of game. Played Quake 3, I think it's Quake, I can't remember what it was, at a company I worked for in about 99. So whatever, 98, 99, whatever Quake was out at the time, we had it on the LAN there, which is brilliant. And the directors of the company joining in at lunchtimes on Quake. Absolutely fantastic. Never really played Doom, so I'm looking forward to actually having a go at Doom and seeing how far I can get on it. So that Jag, 26, well, let's say £30 with the petrol, with the PlayStation, just over 40 quid, and I've got two consoles. Really nice little pickup. Well chuffed with that. That's what I've been up to, really. Not been able to play many games, getting very much back into music production again, so that's taking up a bit of my time, as well as life in general. We moan about this on a lot of the podcasts, that life in general takes over, and it really does. I think as we get older, time seems to compress and go quicker and quicker, and time gets shorter and shorter, and we've all got more responsibilities in life. So those small moments you can snatch for playing a game or two, or whatever you want to do hobby wise grab them while you can. We're not going to be here forever, and nor are our things and possessions. Anyway, onwards and upwards to the Dino Dini interview, part two.
This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
So you've, as you've said, quite heartfelt that was the end of your career. What was life after goal for you for many years? Because I've seen sort of the timeline of you went to the 3DO company in the late 90s. What happened between those dates?
Yeah, so, okay, what happened? I mean, after that, I left Virgin, and I actually in the end got a contract with Microprose eventually, and I wanted to do a PC, a new PC football game. Mm-hmm. And the main thing I was interested in there with that was that, you know, there was a conversion of Gold done by Chris Sawyer.
Yes, he was quite sort of prevalent in doing PC ports, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's one of the things he did. And of course, later on, we all know he had a great success with like Roller Coaster Tycoon and so on.
Ah, of course, yeah.
And I've never he's the last one, by the way, of us that actually had, I think, that actually had a big hit in the charts, like number one hit on it with a game with his name on it.
Yeah.
I think he is the last of us. And he did very well to keep it going that long, and a lot of kudos to him for that. I've never actually met him though, because we worked remotely and transferred files over modem. You know,
what was that, a 9600 board modem? We're in the heady heights of 33.6 by then.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, and it was like, yeah, I think it was like three. I don't know if it was a 300 board modem, but it took a long time. But he did this port, but what he didn't know about was this Mode X, and it wasn't necessarily well known everywhere. So the version that he did used a kind of squash size screen, because it was like a small screen, and the graphics were squashed just to keep the frame rate high, and that was not entirely ideal. So I wanted to do a new version of it, and I actually developed a Mode X graphic engine that was very smooth and worked very well, and then was building a game around that, and that was with Microprose. But in 96, so I probably was working on that for about a year, and then around 96, Microprose sort of were being restructured, and they decided to move out of sports games, so they said, and so they cancelled the project and paid me off. So it was, you know, it was like they paid me as kind of a severance on it. And
yeah.
And at that point I went and I said, you know, I'm not going to be able to carry on like this. I need to figure out how to work in companies. Mm-hmm. And just to put it in perspective, I've never done that.
Right. Okay.
You know, it's always been like an individual.
Yeah.
So I took the plunge and moved to America with my family, mm-hmm. Worked at various companies in the US, one of which was 3DO.
Mm-hmm. So this was after the console, wasn't it?
This was, yes. By the time I got to 3DO, this was after they had sold the console part of the business off. And they were just a straightforward video game publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah, I worked at a few companies in the US, and I learned a lot from it. It was also a very difficult period of time. And I did work a bit, mainly because it was quite traumatic trying to fit into the corporate environment. Mm-hmm. And I'm a rebel. I'm not, you know, if a company hires someone like me, they can't expect me to follow everybody else, because that's not what I do. In fact, I did a talk about that as a topic, you know, for innovation at the DigiWorld Summit or whatever, and I like to use the analogy of ants. Like, ants are very good at following each other, but there are some ants that actually go out on their own on trails, because you know, otherwise the ants would never find new food. And I think some of us are made to be in a certain way, you know, and that's, I'm one of those type of ants.
And I guess when you've worked essentially for yourself, or remotely from a company for so long, it must be incredibly hard to get back into that working culture. Incredibly hard.
Yeah, it is. And it's also difficult. And I really, you know, piled it on, frankly, because I was also working in a culture that I was unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned a lot from it, and I'm glad I did it, but it was not an easy experience by any means.
Yeah.
And some ways also sad. I think, for me, the saddest part of all of that was 3DO, because 3DO was this large company full of talented people, and some of them were really nice. And I had the honor of meeting some real veterans of the industry, like Todd Fry, who coded the a Pac-Man on the 2600,
right.
You know, yeah. And Rob Zadibble, who has a long list of, these are guys that worked at the original, you know, the original Atari, you know, yes, way yes. back. They're really, really great people.
Mm.
And the company failed. I could see why, and I could see it happening, and yeah. and I could see the potential, and I'm still a romantic, and I think games are great, you know, and there's so much potential for this art form, and yeah, it's kind of sad. I look fondly on some of the parts of that, but then on the other hand, it was traumatic. There was that game, the Three Lions, that I yes. did at the first company I worked at. And actually, I was involved in that development quite intensively of the game, but I don't talk about it too much because I don't. It was not, in the end, the design that I was looking for. And
okay.
I was a lot of problems with other people thinking, you know, that they knew better about how to design a football game.
Sure. Sure.
And they're entitled their opinion, but it was a bad hiring decision that they made then to bring me on, because you don't bring someone like me on to make a football game and then think that you know how to make a football game better.
So almost overruling your design choices.
It was difficult, and I guess I learned a lot of lessons that way, you know, and it's fine. You know, I'm not saying I'm the best person in the world at making football games, but clearly you don't. If you hire someone like me to make a football game, then you have to have faith that I know what I'm doing.
Absolutely, and they must have hired you for a reason as well, and that sole reason, surely.
Well, you'd think so, but I don't know. I don't really want to go there too far. It's not actually that interesting.
No,
anyway, yeah. But just say I went off on a five-year mission, and I did learn a lot about that. And then I came back in 2001 or so. And then I came back to an industry in Europe that was in problems. You know, it was the bubble had burst of the internet boom yep. type thing. Studios were closing down. You know, it's like you might remember Rage. Was it Rage or
yes.
Rare?
Rage, yes.
Yeah, I was which, of course. And they folded in around 2001, 2002 or something. We've seen a long litany the last 10-12 years of the video game industry has been quite difficult.
Yeah.
And so basically what that meant for me is that I really didn't have anywhere to go, and I'd been out of the scene over here for a long time, and my confidence was a bit shot as well. And then but I found Trecision in Italy, and I have a big following in Italy. And they wanted to make a football game, so I made a football game with them, and it was called we called it Soccer 2.
Okay.
And we took the prototype of this game over to America, tried to find a publisher, almost got assigned with Sega,
right?
But that didn't come through, because I later learned it didn't come through only because Sega over in Japan had put a freeze on new contracts.
Right.
And the tragedy is that as Trecision folded, they ran out of money and went bankrupt before that block cleared. And so
right.
I only found out this year, actually, that the details of this story, of why it happened, that it went down. It's like, if we could have stayed around, if the timing had been a bit different, if I could have, would have,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I could have had that. I could have worked with Trecision to actually get that football game out. And it would have been great, but it didn't happen.
What platform was that for?
When we were developing at the time for the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox and PC, we were doing cross-development. So okay. we had a prototype on all these platforms. Yeah, it just wasn't to be, and this has kind of been the story ever since for me. It just seems like it just happened over and over again. So after that, I spent 2 years working with DC Studios.
Yeah, I was going to come onto that one myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so DC Studios, and I was just at a conference. I think it was one of the last ECTS shows. Do you remember that European Computer Trade Show?
I went to one in 1992, I believe. Yes.
Yeah. And they've gone now, haven't they? For several years.
Long gone.
I think it was one of the last ones that I was there, and for some reason I was looking at this guy selling middleware, and I was just standing there waiting to speak to him, but I wasn't sure exactly why. And as I stand there, someone claps me on the shoulder, and it was Andrew McLennan, who at the time was working, and I think he was like with one of the Monkees, a studio called Steel Monkees, I think it was. But he had moved on from there and was working with DC Studios, and he recognized me, and we started talking and about doing a football game, and before I knew it, I got a contract. But it didn't end well. We developed a fully playable prototype from scratch. Codename originally Soccer 3.
Yes.
And then later Total Control Football. They were supposed to publish the game, and they didn't. In fact, they tried to sell the game to other publishers, which I, you know, could told them that it was never going to work. And there isn't a publisher in the world that wanted to go up against EA. So, you know, that's all part of the problem. Yeah, that ended nastily. In spite of the fact that I had actually built what I was meant to build, which was a football game prototype, as one of the people who worked with me said, it does what it says on the tin, you know.
And this was 3D, was it? Side
view, top view? Of course, yeah. Both of these were full 3D. So that I've developed twice full 3D, if not counting the three lions, full 3D versions of my games, basically, more along leaning towards Gold than Kickoff 2.
Yeah.
And with some great things that were in there, like, you know, it was still sticking to my philosophy. So you aimed the shots, you used the analog controller to aim the shots, you could swerve the ball, and you could still, you know, head the ball, and actually it was even possible, I think with the Soccer 3 version, you could actually dribble, juggle with the ball.
Okay, yeah.
You could head the ball between players, but you were still actually aiming all the shots. So this is the thing that FIFA, at least until recently, maybe they've changed things recently, was not able to do. You know, that it would take the shots for you. But I was sticking to the old philosophy. I solved the problems of how to make the animations tie up so that, you know, the ball would actually, you know, be very close to the actual part of the body that it was supposed to touch, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
And it was done. I was really happy with the way it was going, but it just, both times, both companies, it didn't work out. They both ran out of money is the actual story. I know it ended badly, but DC Studios folded not very long after they effectively tore up the contract. So, and at that point, I have to say, when that happened, I was probably at the lowest I've been in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. So that's quite interesting, really. Just before we come on to that side of it, and I'm sure other people want to know, what happens to these unfinished games? Where does the code go? Who owns the IP? And can we get it?
Can we get it? I don't know who owns the IP for Soccer 2. Could have been bought by somebody, but it probably wasn't. When the company went into receivership, the assets would have been sold on.
Yeah.
I could go back and try and find it and purchase it, but it's not worth it. Part of the reason why is because it was based around that engine. Oh God, the one everybody was using, the one that was in.
Unity is the only one that springs to
mind. No, we'll go back. It's not Unity. No, it was
Unreal.
No.
No. I've run
I'm just
out
drawn
ideas.
A complete blank on this one. Sometimes I wonder.
Renderware.
Thank you very much. Renderware. That's the one.
That's the words of Google, no less.
Renderware. Exactly. Renderware. I mean, Renderware's long gone because it got bought out by EA. But both Soccer 2 and Soccer 3 were using Renderware.
Okay.
And that's kind of like a dead platform now. What happens to these games is that often they just disappear. Maybe they get bought by another studio. Maybe the IP is worth something, but more often than not, they just die. Because the cost of taking any of these and trying to turn them into something that you can sell is usually too high. And then there's the psychological side of it too, is I don't want to go back there.
Sorry. No, from your personal point of view, it's probably not very healthy, is it really?
I just don't want to know.
I mean, there's a whole culture of finding these old games. I don't know whether you're aware of this, certainly on the Amiga and the Commodore 64, ST and that, there's a whole culture of people trying to find old unfinished games and getting the code for them. To not develop them into finished games, but to develop them into a playable version, so they're not lost forever, so they are archived somewhere. Obviously, with the later games, you know, 2004 with the Soccer 3 prototype, things were much bigger then, weren't they? You know, the whole development, you know, we're just talking even file size, was bigger than what it was back in the Amiga and the 8-bit days. So it's much easier to get that code because it sits on one floppy disk compared to, I don't know what Soccer 3 fit on, but it was probably a hard drive or two.
CD, you know. The whole development environment, you know, it was probably stuck on a CD somewhere or whatever. Mm. I think that's true. I'd love to show off, but I'm still too raw.
Yes, yeah.
It's still too raw. I you know, this is one of those things that just seems to haunt me. It's like I obviously did something in a previous life and I'm getting punished for it. It's like to do. Jeff Minter understands, though, because he tweeted this a while back. He said, I don't understand why I'm doing the best work that I've done and I'm not able to sell any copies. Or something like that. He's hardly selling any copies of the game and he's doing the best work he did. In my case, I did the best work I've done twice over and not even being able to get it into the hands of people to play it.
I mean, some people would argue now, why don't you do it again in the indie world? But I can almost preempt your answer of it's...
Go on, then.
It's massively hard to make an impact in a very saturated market. And you look at Jeff Minter as the perfect point in question there. A very respected and almost established producer, coder. You can't make a wave in this big world of what is essentially was a great model. The App Store is now saturated and it's all now big Angry Birds type things, isn't it? It's big franchises now, where it was once back to the bedroom program again, the back bedroom program.
Yeah, I think it's great what's happened with the indie is back, and that's wonderful. It really, really is wonderful, because the industry was destroyed by the anti-indie thing, you know. I really do mean that when I say it was destroyed. The creative heart of the industry was torn out, and now it's kind of healing.
Yeah.
But there is a difficulty there, that there's no continuity. The people who, like Jeff and many others, like David Braben, yeah. I mean, you know, this is a crazy thing. It's like, okay, you know, Dino, you know, yeah, you did a few soccer games, but you know, you're just sort of like bitter because nobody wants to really play your games anymore and pay you to make them go away. You know, I could say, okay, but you've actually seen this happen with, like, you know, flipping heck, David Braben. David Braben to me is like, you know, sometimes I get people come up to me and say, you know, they want my autograph or whatever. It's, oh, I'm talking to Dino. I can't be. But there are certain people, like David Braben is the one that I'm sure he wouldn't say two words to me, but he's
sure that's not true.
He's like, you know, God to me. Because when I was like 16, 17, whenever it was, probably it was 17, 18, I don't know. I got the original Elite on the BBC Micro, right? This was just a work of genius, and that wasn't just him, it was also Ian Bell.
Yeah.
Very, very important game, and a wonderful work of video game art, as far as I'm concerned, you know. And where, after he did Frontier, which had some problems with going too realistic there for it to work, I think, in my opinion, but, you know, where has this follow-up been? So even David Braben hasn't been able to do a follow-up.
Yeah.
Until now, he's managed to get funding for Elite Dangerous.
Yes, yes.
And I'm really, really happy about that. And it fills me with hope for the future. But there has been a break in continuity. It's not like... It's that Jeff Minter hasn't been able to capitalize on 20 years of building up an indie following. He's having to start from scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like I am, really. And David Braben, in a way, has to. It's just that his following is... I mean, he's bigger... probably than both of us, you know. His following was really strong, and he managed to pull off an amazing feat on the Kickstarter.
Yeah,
I'm really, really happy for that. But you get my point. It's like, you know,
it's still a big drop in the big wide ocean, isn't it?
It is, and because there hasn't been a careful, we haven't been able to keep our in touch with our fans and keep producing games and getting them published over the last 20 years. We are stuck in the middle of nowhere. So yeah, yeah. I think it's a lot of hope for the new guys who come out there, but people like us, and certainly I'll only speak for me, I'm a bit burnt by the whole process of what's happened. And programming games is almost like, feels like it's becoming a hobby as much as my music is.
Yeah, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting point you made there, and I think listeners would be very interested to hear that a god to you is David Braben, where... You know, if you take those Amiga 16-bit ST days, while, okay, Frontier was a massive game, but in my opinion, Kickoff 2 and Goal were massive games as well. And you were, to an average gamer at the time, you were on an even keel, I would say. So it's just a really interesting comment, and interesting to hear you say that to you, someone like that is God. It's just a very interesting comment, I think.
Well, you have to remember that for me, it's like I was still a teenager when the game came out. It was before I had made a name for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I'm just a regular game player. I'm a regular young pioneering gamer.
Yes.
And they did stuff on the computer that I couldn't do, even though I had already been programming for many years. I didn't have the mathematical skills to do what they were doing. So I didn't know how to do 3D. So when I saw this 3D stuff coming at me, I was just blown away by it.
And in the footprint that it was in of 32K, wasn't it, the BBC at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to say, well, it must have been written in 12K because the video RAM was 20. But I think I've seen later that they actually used tricks to keep the video RAM smaller.
Okay.
So I think the game fit into, I think, 20K maybe. But
just
even so,
crazy,
it,
isn't
it? It is still a very small amount of code to create such a classic game. Mind you, Star Raiders was 8K.
I mean, it's just, we were talking about this recently in the podcast we did about the Acorn Archimedes, and the fact that I have a text file open at the moment, which has my pointers in it, which is probably bigger than the whole of Elite was on the BBC or the Commodore 64. And the gamers of today just cannot perceive what was achieved back in those old days with such small amounts of resources.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I went through a phase when I started when I was playing Star Raiders last year or something on Twitter. I kept posting 8K, and I don't know whether anybody got why I kept saying 8K exclamation. It's just there's a message there. Yeah. And this is, again, this is what hurts some of the classic indie designers, that the missing continuity, the missing link or whatever, is that, you know, everything has gone ballistic when it didn't need to.
Yeah.
You can create an entertaining game in a very tiny footprint or very small amount of technology. It is possible to do that because what the real heart of a game is something beyond the size of the graphics and the number of polygons and the screen resolution.
And I think mobile gaming has reinforced that point a little bit, hasn't it?
I think so. I think it really has. I think people have started to get, you know, I think the illusion of big game, you know, it was like they've got big data and big farmer, and you know, there was going to be big game. It feels like that was the intention, you know. It's like big game. It hasn't worked out, and part of it is because it's an illusion. You don't need big game. What you need is fun game. Yes. So there are a few things I think that start to pull, you know, take the wool out of the eyes, so to speak, if that's the right expression, which are things like you know, Angry Birds, for example.
So
what's the point of being a AAA studio with everybody working all kinds of hours, not having a life, pulling together all these assets with production values that go through the roof and so on, when you could have just been a smallish team making a game called Angry Birds and you've got a business?
Absolutely.
You know, so that's the first one. Then there's Notch. and Minecraft.
Yes.
I read recently he was saying how it was really weird that he made $101 million in a year. I don't know if that figure's right. I mean, let's say it was. So this is a guy, one guy by himself. If that's true, he's managed to earn more money than the entire development budget for Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah.
By himself. Why? How? Because he managed to find a good design.
That's right. Yeah, he's tapped into it, hasn't he? Perfectly.
Yeah, he was. He. There is an element of luck here. The design is not 100% original. I can tell you, it derives from other games. The fact that when I played it, the first thing I thought, this is a 3D version of Rogue.
Okay.
I don't know if you know the game Rogue.
I don't know. No.
Also, a later version of it was called NetHack.
That rings a bell, but
okay. Well, these are ASCII okay. Dungeon crawlers,
right?
That were played on ASCII terminals and ran on mainframes.
Yes.
So we're going way back, but it was important games as well. But and this is not to diminish at all what Minecraft is, but. But I mean, you know, clearly there's an issue if you've got like one guy can take on an entire industry, and this is really great. But you know, like I said, we've had a break in between. There's a kind of the audience needs to be re-educated as well. I'm wandering off now, so I think you better pull me back.
But is there a career in indie games, so to speak? You know, there might be a resurgence of that type of game, but is there a pay the bills kind of career to be had in it, other than what we've just spoken about? Those, you know, the one person that's hit upon a great recipe that's created millions of pounds for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's the lottery, isn't it? I mean, Notch might be a good designer, video game designer. I think he's got talent, absolutely. And I also think it's a lottery, because you could take probably 100 Notches who had done effectively the same thing, and one of them maybe would have that effect. It's the viral thing. There's no doubt about it that Minecraft went viral, and then you know that when something goes viral, it can go very, very big. Yeah. And I'm not saying it didn't deserve to. I think it's actually really, really good game, and it's really worked out. And it's still also a lottery. I think there are other great games out there that we never get to see.
Definitely.
So, I mean, you know, can you make a living from it? It comes back to a theme. When I went to speak in Rome, I opened up the first video game museum in Rome, first Italian video game museum.
Brilliant.
When I was in Rome, I at one point I walked into this square, and there were these artists all painting and selling their art. And so you've got this guy, and I have photographs of this guy, and he's doing his artwork, spraying on sort of paper on on the floor. There was cans of paint everywhere and all this kind of stuff. And his artwork was actually really good. Well, he's selling his art on the street, as many others were. Mm-hmm. And it's perfectly respectable. But, I mean, you know, isn't this... This really struck home to me a reality, which is that the danger with the way... danger or the way the video game industry is going is that way. In the end, it's going to be, and I would say if we're not careful, it's just going to be like a cottage industry. It's like people, but a cottage, no, that's the wrong one, not even a cottage industry. It's going to be just like being a painter. You know, you might love painting, and painting is what you love to do, but if you expect it to bring you comfort, material things in your life, it isn't going to do it unless you're really, really lucky.
It just becomes a churn then, doesn't it, really, to make that living.
Well, that's one thing as well. When it becomes a churn, then it loses its effectiveness, doesn't it, and its purpose. But I think it's, we're seeing an increasing number of games that are indie games that are non-commercial. People are beginning to make games because they want to make games, but they're not having any illusion to actually being able to sell them. But like with music, you know, people playing music or being in a band. I think there are lots of bands in the world, but I'm quite sure that very few of them are actually there for the purpose of making money.
Yeah, a lot of do it for the, well, the majority do it for the love, I would say. It's actually the minority now that make the money, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the way we're going. And I think that, in a sense, that's sad, because I think it's sad in all art. I think if people who... We should encourage art in our culture, because, you know, that's the thing that gives us a reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just to go on a bit of a self-indulgent trip as well, and this might not actually make the cut. I'm a fan of Marillion. I don't know whether you, being a jazz fan, you might not know of Marillion, but...
I've heard of them.
Yes, so they've been going since 1979, actually formed in my hometown, as it is. But they basically pioneered the internet model that we're seeing with Kickstarter now. In about 98, 99, they were the first band with a website, a first big band with a website, and they went out to their fans and said, "Would you, because we have no longer have a record deal, would you fund our next album by pre-ordering it?" And they put a figure on it of £50,000, and they actually got £150,000 of pre-orders. And they've done, I think it's about 90% of their albums ever since, on that model alone.
It's great, but they had a fan base.
Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah,
that's
absolutely
it. True. You've got to have that. And so David Braben has a fan base.
Yes.
And so he's managed to raise the money from that. Yeah, so, you know, it's great, and I think that's definitely the future. And that is the other side of the coin too, because it all sounds a bit kind of sad and all that, but then I have to remember that there is this hope on the horizon, which comes from crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And when Elite was going through its final days, it was nerve-wracking, actually, with Elite.
Even though I watched it as well,
And I mean, I'm not connected with the project in any way other than that I backed it. It meant a lot to me to see that, because for me, that's representative of something important in the industry I love.
Yeah.
And it was nerve-wracking, because for a while it looked like it wasn't going to make it. You know,
yeah, absolutely. I think it was about 3 days before, it was still at about 900,000, wasn't it?
It was the last week. It was an incredible pickup in the last week. Mm-hmm. At one point, it was looking like, dodgy. I was there watching, as I watched it go up, is it going to make it? Is it going to make it? And then it broke through the barrier, and I was like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Because it maybe this gives another hope. Of course, at some point, then there are going to be Kickstarters all the time, and then maybe you get the problem of too many.
It's going to saturate like every other market, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, so I don't know, but it's better than anything we've had before. So I think there is hope there.
Definitely.
And we will see. And even just the fact that it's not just video games. I mean, I backed and backing a couple of jazz musicians. One got funded and the other one is looks like may well get funded as well. And so these are just independent jazz artists trying to do their thing. And I listened to their recordings. I said, you know, I can't remember who it is now. She's got a fantastic voice. I said, okay, I'm going to back that. And it's turning the whole thing on its head. So that's encouraging. So if you would say, is there an opportunity for making a living? I think there is, but you've got to have talent and you've got to be patient and you have to build up a following.
Yes. Yes.
And it's all about community. That is the currency of the new order here.
Definitely. And I think that's across a lot of industries as well. Music, certainly, being one of them. Any of the arts industries, I think, you need that following to get anywhere. So, right, let's come back to the more retro-y side of things quickly. Gaming. Do you game now? Do you still game? Do you emulate? Or are you just sort of a lecturer and a teacher in this world?
Well, I have to be honest with you, Chris. Ever since the disasters of the 2000s years, those things, I got a bit disillusioned with the whole gaming thing.
Yeah.
So there has been a period of time that I haven't really been playing many games. And then just this year, this last 12 months, it's not this, yeah, whatever, things have started warming up to it, back to it again. And going back and looking at some old games that I used to play a lot, and revisiting them. So one particular one I think I mentioned was Magic Carpet. And I really recommend that for any retro people, players out there, gamers out there who haven't played it. There's a lot of interest in that particular game.
Yeah, I'm surprised I've never picked that one out, because I was very interested in it when it was being previewed in the magazine. So I'm definitely going to pick that one out and have a go on that.
I highly recommend it. Just make sure that you turn down the CPU speed.
Okay.
And if you hit R, you can go high res. So you want to do that, and then make sure that it's playing at a reasonable speed, otherwise you're not going to get there. Yeah. And you need to read the instructions, because it's one of those games that's not directly intuitive. You have to learn how to use the interface. So unfortunately, it's an old game. You have to read the instructions to get it. But once you get it, it doesn't take that long. It's an awful lot of fun. It's kind of missing a tutorial level, basically.
Yes, yes. So do you emulate anything else, or is it just DOSBox at the moment?
DOSBox, I think, is really the only thing I've been doing on emulation, unless you count. I was just playing Metal Gear Solid the other day on my PlayStation 2, but I bought that. You buy these old games now and they're emulated on the PlayStation 3.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I said PlayStation 2, but PlayStation 2 game emulated on the PlayStation 3. So in actual playing retro games, I'm not really playing that many retro games. What I am doing is I did play Journey recently. Now, this is a PlayStation 3 game available on PSN. Mm-hmm. And it's a remarkable game. It's very different. It forms a new genre that I call, anyway, a transformational game. And it's because rather like a very good film, it leaves you changed when you finished watching it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there was a game, I never actually played it, but I saw it and someone showed me the game, but I have to admit, I never actually played it. It was a game called Ico. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I know about that, and I know it was quite... I think it wasn't commercially very successful, but certainly the gameplay was very different and very revolutionary almost.
It was. And in fact, there's one I need to put to my list, because I really should play that game. And there's nothing to prevent me doing that now, I guess. Maybe it's available on the PSN. I'll have to check that out.
I think it got re-released with another game for the PS3, and it was essentially the PS2 versions. So it was on a dual disc.
Oh, okay.
Game. Yeah.
I need to check that out. But anyway, yeah, so the reason I bring up ICO is that I think it's ICO was one of the first that tried to make an emotional connection. So we're talking about games that I think you can have a transformational game. It's not necessary that it's emotional thing is the hook. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these ones are. So it's made by that game company. They also made Flower, the game Flower. And I'm just going to make a prediction, which is that I think that the next big thing in games is growing right now, is these transformational games. Maybe they're not there for they're not particularly long. You know, I think you can play Journey in 3 hours. The purpose of it is not extended gameplay over a long period of time. It's an experience that you have. It is a work of art.
Okay, I'm definitely going to seek that one out then, because having a short game is quite important to me, because I don't have the time to sit down to sort of 50 hours of gameplay. So,
well, if you're on PSN, really try that one out, because it's many, many people who played it afterwards, they go, wow. And it's not a wow because there's complex gameplay in there. It's just wow because it's so beautifully done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Yeah. Have you got any loyalty to a particular computer? For me, 80s was Commodore 64 for me. I had a Spectrum, but I moved to the Commodore 64. Love the Commodore 64 still. I have many of them lying around the house, mainly for the SID chip more than anything. Was there any particular computer or platform that really is heartfelt to you almost?
I don't think so. I've had so many, and they all had their own qualities, mm-hmm. and they remain with me as a feeling, which is always fascinating me. It's like, what does that feeling mean? But it's like they all had their own flavors. I'm just thinking, which one? I mean, would it be the Atari 800, Atari 400, the BBC Micro, the Acorn Atom, the Atari ST, the Commodore Amiga? Yeah, those are the main ones to answer. They all had some good qualities to them. Mm-hmm. So I can't really give an answer to that one.
No. Do they represent a point in time for you, though? You know, could you, if you looked at one now and played a specific game on it, would it take you back to that time, do you think? Would it give you that emotion? Or would it just be, I remember that and that's about it?
I think it's... Yeah, I think there's a certain element of that. It's like anything, isn't it? It's like, do you know that cities... When you visit a different city, do you find that those cities have different feel to them? They give you a different feeling.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you can't really put this feeling into words, but it's something I love when I visit a city for the first time, and then I walk out of the station or wherever, however I've landed there, and I'm in the city, and then I go, I know the city. Okay, I know, I understand the energy of the city. Mm-hmm. And it's different from any other city I've ever been in before. It's a bit like that with everything.
Yeah.
And so it's like that with computers too.
That sounds very emotional to me. That sounds like an emotional response to something.
I don't know whether it's emotional or not. It's because emotion is... It's a non-intellectual response, certainly. It's... Yeah, I can't really put my finger on it. And what I suppose I am muttering about here is that every single computer that I've ever worked with has its own character and its own feel.
Yeah.
And it's where that comes from. I know where it comes from. I'm going to go a little metaphysical here, maybe. But every single thing that's ever been created by a human being as the result of being designed would have been designed by an individual or been designed by a group of people.
Yeah.
The fact that it was designed and now exists as a result of that design means that it carries within it a little bit of everyone who designed it. Mm-hmm. All right. And just like in a city, the city carries a little bit of everybody who lives in the city. Right.
Yeah.
And you tune into that. And that's for me what it is. So it's almost like on certain computers where they were designed in a certain way that creates a feeling.
Yeah, it's a very wonderful way of looking at it, actually. Yeah.
And I can't say there's a favourite. But one of the things that's been nice recently as I've been trying to get back to the Dino Jr., as I put it in my blog,
yes,
is go back to this and appreciate it, is that I am feeling those feelings again. You know, when I found my old BBC Micro, which we actually donated to the museum, the Vigamus Museum in Rome, it's actually on display there now, my BBC Micro, but I hadn't made contact with this BBC Micro for years, and then it's this thing I used to sit in front of, and it's like, yeah, you can't help but get a feeling, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that totally. Yeah,
don't have any particular favourite. No,
okay. For me, very very easy. Amiga and Commodore 64 were my things, and I think for me it's very emotional. It's about almost reliving those times. To a certain extent, I will not play certain games so I don't almost erase those memories of those times. So I can say mine is a very emotional, heartfelt thing, but I understand where you're coming from totally.
Well, I think that's right, but yeah, I think the thing to bear in mind is that you probably spent a lot of time in your teens,
mm-hmm.
if I'm right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it was. Yeah.
Your teens playing these games, and that's another aspect too, isn't it? Is the teen, your teens is such a formative period of time.
Definitely.
You identify, there's a lot that goes on with people in their teens. And then really the games, they could have been anything, but you had games, become a kind of anchor, don't they? They were a way... No, I mean I'm now reading your mind, so I don't.
No, you are absolutely spot on. For in those years, I did very little else other than listen to music and use my computers, whether it was playing games or I used to make music on the Amiga as well. And yeah, that was it for me. That was my life essentially.
Right, and I've had people say to me, which is amazing when they say this, I go, wow. They said, you're the reason I managed to keep my sanity. You know, the game that you made kept me going. You know, that's just like, and when I hear that, I go, what the hell? It's like, what do you mean? It's a football game. But it's,
it
connected, you know, and I don't know, if I had a message for people who wanted to understand what video games really are, I'd say they are art. Because they do that, the people were playing, they could have been listening to music, they could have been reading books, right? They could have been doing activities like sports, and different people find a different anchor in their lives or something to focus their energies, and it can be video games as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you really want proof that video games are art, isn't that proof really?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, you're spot on. It's from a different angle from where I'm coming from, but you're also spot on at exactly the same time, so great way of looking at it. I've got a question from the forum that someone wanted to know about sort of the iterative yearly releases of games. You know, we're looking at the FIFAs, the sports games that are year on year, slight improvement, slight tweak. Do you think that they have a place, or is it just cashing in?
That's a good question. I think, first of all, I think it's important to be realistic about the thing of cashing in, because it depends. If you're EA, even if you're EA, cash is a problem. I mean, they're trying to sell themselves, aren't they? Trying to find a buyer for themselves, you know. Mm. I mean, there's nothing wrong in selling something that people want to buy. Nobody goes and forces anybody to buy these sequels or these updates.
Yeah.
So I don't see anything wrong with that at all. I do think that it's different from making a new original game, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think as well that the mainstream industry, which seems to be, you know, having problems at the moment, is maybe going away even,
yeah,
relied on that too much, so that not just the not just the follow-up like the FIFAs and so on, but also just always making the same kinds of games, mm-hmm, and shutting out the indies so that they couldn't actually continue innovating, and that had the effect of training people into expecting sequels and so on. So it kind of corrupted the market, I think, or mm-hmm, dumbed the market down. So I think it causes damage. It actually causes damage to the industry if it's done exclusively. So I think it's a balance, you know. I think you can see this as well with like Rovio with Angry Birds.
Yes.
You know, you could say, oh my God, they're creating every single kind of version of Angry Birds that they can think of, and they're just, you know, putting out more levels and you know, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it's up to them, you know. I think if I'm a video game developer, as a video game developer, I wouldn't want to do that forever. I'd want to start breaking new ground, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think there should always be room for something new, but don't get too pissed off when companies that often find it difficult to actually make money try to create a revenue or find a revenue stream that involves repetition and people are willing to pay for it, then that's fine, isn't it?
That's the key point, isn't it? People are willing to pay for it, and like you said, they're not being forced into it. So
they're not being forced into it, you know. So this whole thing about, oh, they're milking it to death, well, you know, sometimes you have to milk it to death.
Yes.
You know, maybe you milk it to death until it's dead, then you make the new thing. It kind of makes sense.
It does. Brilliant. Now, that was Trantor in the forums. Thank you very much for that. Another one, I've kind of integrated a lot of these questions into what we've spoken about previously, but one from Jacko Lantern. What footy games would you recommend to someone not into football? So that's quite interesting, because both you and myself are not into football. Yet you've written a football game, and I love those football games.
What football game would I recommend to people who are not into football? I would recommend that they wait until eventually at some point in the distant future, maybe a future lifetime, I come up with a new one. I don't know.
I'd join that thought as well.
I don't really know. I mean, try them. You try them out. I mean, if you're not really into football, then you want a game with good gameplay. You know?
Yes.
So then what football games are there out there right now that have great gameplay? I don't know, because I don't actually follow the football game scene. It's too painful for me to. Maybe at some point I will again, but I just don't really look at what's out there.
Yeah.
In that domain. But, you know, just ask people, what's the most fun one? Let me look for fun. That's the answer, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm sure you can find fun in every type of game as well. You know, people like FIFA, people like the other ones at Pro Evolution, and that's pretty much what we've got for football games at the moment, really. You can get fun out of those, I think. But for me, it's not my type of game. It's too fiddly. They're both of them are too fiddly. So I wouldn't recommend either, but that's not to say that someone else... Clearly,
no.
Many millions of people get a lot of enjoyment out of them.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about fiddly, because you were saying you preferred one button.
Yes. My simple mind prefers it.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, that is quite a barrier, having multiple buttons, you know.
Mm.
So, anyway, sorry, that was just a...
Yeah.
That was just a side thing.
Yeah, so... You wrote a blog post after the Play Expo, which is where I met you and went along to as well. I thought it was a great show. Maybe not so much the newer stuff, but the retro side of it was really, really nice, really friendly, really vibrant as well. Did it open your mind up to the world of retro? Were you blissfully unaware of it at that point? What did it do for you?
Oh, well, you remember when I said about, you know, how every computer has a feeling, mm-hmm. yeah, as an energy, as a, I don't know, whatever, you know, like a city does. So you can imagine when I walked into that room and I saw all these old computers, including BBC Micros and so on. I thought it was wonderful. And I think it's important as well. We've archived a lot of stuff that was culturally important. We should archive video games.
Definitely.
And there's some challenges with that. Like, what the hell do we do when the TVs are all dead?
Mm.
You know, because then you can't recreate the experience. You have to use some other kind of, maybe we can find a flat screen thing, but it's not the same experience anymore. I think that's the thing that I'm, one of the things I took away from that is a lesson that it's the quality of the things that we experience that are more important than their specifications.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you could say, well, look, you're playing on this old computer that's really not very fast and on that, you know, crappy tube TV that was in fashion 20 years ago or something, you know, and you go, but that is not the point. The point is that the whole experience of playing that game, that TV with the imperfections of the display and so on, and the joysticks and the way they were shaped and the little quirks of the system. You can even go extreme and say the ritual of loading the game from tape was all part of the experience.
Absolutely,
you know?
Was, yeah.
And you lose that. And you see that with music. There was a ritual with... The best thing for me about vinyl is it reminds me of the ritual of music that is lost.
Definitely.
You know, you go... I used to take a CD. I can't even call them CDs now. You know, right? I used to take an album and you take it out of the thing and you clean it. It's like you put it on the turntable, you put the little arm on, you know, whatever it was called. I can't even remember what the thing was called now. It was an arm, wasn't it? I don't know.
There's an arm with a cartridge with
the stylus and thing on it. But did you call it an arm? I don't know.
It was an arm. Yeah,
absolutely. It was called an arm. Okay, mm-hmm. That's great. Well done, Dino. And then I would go and sit on the couch and just listen to the whole side. And that's what I would do. It was like 100%. I am listening to music. That's what I'm doing now. And we don't do that anymore. Now music is kind of incidental to something else that we're doing. The ritual is gone.
Yes.
And I think that's a kind of heightened that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the whole thing of keeping alive these old games of the retro scene, I think is incredibly important. And I'd never really thought about it before. It was the first retro event, the replay event, was the first retro event I'd been to. And that was wonderful. I always had this thing about pinball machines, right? So the pinball section was one of my favorite parts because it's like all these pinball machines. And I'm looking at them because I'm also a techno person. I like thinking about the way things work and so on. And I'm looking at all these old components, like these displays that are using the vacuum tube with a filament in them and so on, and these things, you can't make them anymore. And I was asking some guy, and he said, what do you do when they don't exist anymore? And he says, well, I guess we have to fake them with LEDs, you know. Mm. it's great stuff.
It is. An interesting dynamic I thought of while I was there was when we were at those times in life where you had the battles of the platforms, people were, you know, we had these playground battles between Spectrum, the BBC, the Commodore, whatever. But now, it's all for one, isn't it? Everyone's joined together for the one cause. You might still have a preference, of course, but you've not got people battling over, like you say, about technical specifications. It's about celebrating the fact that we are still playing them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. The fact that the people are still playing them. And they haven't forgotten.
Yeah.
And I think if there's one thing that any writer of, or creator, designer of retro video games, that will put a smile on their face. It's the thought that their work and effort has not been forgotten.
Yeah, and I can understand that.
And you know, when I was there and I watched a couple of people playing my game, playing Kickoff 2, and I was just standing behind them and they didn't even know I was there, and I was just watching them play the game, and how they were reacting with each other, and you know, all the it's excitement about almost scoring a goal and all the rest of it. And I thought, you know, Dino, you did a good job.
You've touched people with your art, I think.
That's the way I read it.
Mm.
And it kind of sounds obvious, I suppose. I don't know. But what else is it? But it gave me, it helped me. You know, that's what my blog post was about. It actually helped me try and get my mind straight. And I guess the mission I've got is to try and find a way of getting back, you know, going almost full circle here. When we started this interview, you know, there was this bit about, you know, what the success, what happened with when you had the success, how did you cope with it? And then I said about how I was, you know, naive, or you called it naive, but that is right. That is, it was the naivety.
Mm.
The game was born from a naivety, and then you lose that naivety. And so I'm trying to get back to the naivety.
And I think that's what we do by trying to play these retro games, I think.
Yeah, it is. And it's a good thing to try to do. And when I was there and I saw these these two people playing my game, and it was good for me. It just helps me understand that I got to get back to what really matters.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Do you think you'll go to another retro show at any time?
I'd like to do more of these events, and hopefully maybe even do something a little bit more at these events, which is be able to show some kind of new game, or even potentially a new game on an old platform. I've started to get the bug on that.
I was going to ask that very question. have you been inspired to, clearly you have been inspired to start prodding and poking at the old machines again?
Yeah, there's someone I've become friends with, which is a guy in Germany. He's part of the demo scene.
Oh yes, I was a part of that on the Amiga back in the
90s. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And there's still a demo scene going on. There was Revision was the big thing, and they stopped doing the Revision. Oh. Now there's a new Revision event or equivalent going on this Easter. And I'm actually working...
Breakpoint, possibly. Breakpoint?
Yes, that's it. Sorry, yeah. It was called Breakpoint. You're right. Yeah, it was called Breakpoint. Breakpoint got very big and then maybe too big and then it stopped. And now there's Revision, which is kind of the continuing the thing.
Okay.
And they're going to be submitting a demo on... I can't say what the platform is, but it's a very obscure and wonderful little thing. Mm-hmm. And we're working on a demo for it, and I'm actually helping out in the team programming in very ancient assembler on this. And I'm really getting a kick out of it. I went to visit him last weekend, in fact, and we resurrected a Color Genie. Have you ever heard of that one?
Color Genie? Is it handheld, was it?
No, it's a computer that looks a bit like a Vic... I think like a Vic... Looks a bit like a VIC-20, but Color Genie. So it was mainly in Germany that this was released.
Okay.
Okay, so it's an old cassette one, you know. It's going way back, like the BBC Micro era. You know, he maintains a kind of museum of retro equipment and so on. So he said, well, I've just received this box, so let's have a look what's in it. And so there was this Color Genie thing. And so we spent the best part of the weekend bringing it back to life, and it was great. Brilliant. Fun. We had to figure out how to get a program into it, so we eventually managed to get a laptop to generate the audio of the cassette tape and send it into the machine so that it would load up the program and run, and we were playing a version of Donkey Kong. Eventually.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. So you're contributing to a demo on an old platform.
Yeah, I'm contributing to a demo on an old platform, but I guess the whole point of this story is it's made me think, well, you know, if you stop treating game development as being primarily an exercise in making money,
yes,
which is an easy way to look at it because it seems very hard to make any money these days, then you code for fun, then does it matter what platform you code on? Yeah,
not I mean, really. Not
it
really.
Doesn't really matter.
No. Not at all.
In fact, there's quite a bit of fun in trying to see how far you can push an old platform.
I think that's why people still do it. The Commodore 64 has a massively vibrant demo scene still. I'm going to be doing a podcast on it soon, actually, because I say I was a part of the Amiga demo scene for a while. I wasn't particularly prolific or well-known, but it was just an amazing culture to me, and I met some really great people through it, some who I'm still in contact with now. And it was about pushing the machine as far as it could go on limited resources.
Yes, are they still pushing it, or have they reached the limit of how far it can
go? It's unbelievable. What you can see on the Commodore 64 now, I'll send you some links.
I'd love to see offline.
Because they're doing effects that were being done on the Amiga in the 90s, you know, 3D effects, rotating and zooming bitmaps and so forth, and it's really fantastic. And what they're getting out of the sound chip now as well, the SID chip, could be very similar to what it was then, but they're also getting more current with the sound as well, more current in sort of dance music terms.
Yeah, because that's interesting too, isn't it? It's like, well, you had that era of music was interpreted through that medium, and now you've got a whole new kind of music which is being pushed into that medium. I think it's great stuff.
It is. So I'll send you some stuff offline on that, because it is really very interesting. And I've always wanted to be able to properly code and make music on the SID chip, and it's still one of my aims in life. So I'm hoping to get to a proficient enough stage that I can contribute to that demo scene as well. So
Yeah, that sounds good.
Excellent. So we've naturally moved into music a little bit, but we'll keep this reasonably brief. You clearly have a massive passion for music. Would you say it's a bigger passion for music than you've had in your life for computers and computer programming and game development?
I don't really know, to be honest. I don't know that it can be compared. Music for me was part of the way that I survived my teenage years. It was the way of being able to express my feelings. That stayed with me with a 12-year or so break, and then only started about 10 years ago to play again.
Yeah.
I can't really make a distinction between them. In fact, actually, it's in some respects, they're very related. It's just they're related at the core, but the medium of expression is different.
Yes.
You know, it's a different kind of music, but it's music nonetheless. I've actually kind of recently thought about video games as being choreography. If you had to say, we're a video game designer, especially where you're talking about where there's motion, so it's really the kinds of games that I love to do, and the ones that Jeff Minter does as well, very much similar kind of thing, the shooters that he does and so on.
Yeah.
It's a kind of choreography, an interactive choreography. Mm-hmm. And with music, it's like you can think of music like a choreography of notes. But I think they does touch on slightly different parts of me. I mean, you know, I tend to have philosophical way of looking at life and so on, and then sometimes I need to express that. One of the power with music is just the intensity with which it's possible to communicate a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, that's, I think in the end, that's what it's about. And it's great to communicate a feeling in a video game. So this is why I mentioned Journey. Journey actually does do this. It communicates a feeling. Just in the act of playing the game, you get this feeling. But that's, for me, is it's important.
Yeah,
it makes me a whole person. So, yeah, I am pretty... recently I've been very busy, so I haven't been able to go on You Now as much as I'd like to, but for the last year I've been broadcasting live on You Now, and that's been important because it's not practical for me to perform in public because there are no venues pretty much where I live.
Yeah.
So performance of music has always been very important to me. So I could say that in the end, I'm an entertainer. Does it matter whether I entertain with music or I entertain with a video game, I don't really see much difference between the two in the end.
Absolutely, I agree with that. And like you say, music is incredibly powerful. It's a passion of mine. Very different music styles to yourself, but whatever music style someone is into in the genre, I can understand their passion for it, because it touches me in a way that very little else does. It creates massive emotions in me, right from sadness to absolute happiness. So yeah, I can understand your passion for it. I think that's about it, Dino. So I'd like to thank you for your time, and it has been quite a long time, so I really, really appreciate that. Is there anything else you would like to put out there? Would you like to promote your blog at all? Tell us about what you might have coming up, or anything else other than that.
What I might have coming up, I have got a number of irons in the fire, so to speak. But none of it is really commercial at this point. Okay. None of it is anything that I want to necessarily announce. But I'm trying to find my way back into sort of a sustainable independent game development.
Okay.
But one thing I can say, I've got a website, not very interesting. Don't have time to update it. The only thing I would advertise, if I can plug something, is just my Twitter feed.
Okay. Because,
so that's DNDN1011.
Okay, that's fine.
Absolutely. And that's more Twitter followers I get, the more progress I feel I'm making towards a community based around, you know, the kinds of things that I do. So, which could include video games.
Absolutely. I would like to personally promote your blog, because it's a very interesting read as well. So I'm very much following that. And also, as Dino said, he does music on You Now, essentially you a guitar and a microphone.
Yeah, and I guitar and I sing. Sometimes I play a bit of trumpet occasionally, some violin, though that's quite rare because I'm not really that good at it. the thing is, if you follow if people follow me on Twitter, then when I'm broadcasting, there's always a message that it always gets tweeted on Twitter, so that's a good way to stay in touch with that if anyone's interested. Yeah,
brilliant stuff. Well, again, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to interview you.
Yeah, it's been good fun, actually. I've enjoyed it, so thank you too.
Thank you very much.